Good evening.
Good evening.
Tonight we are going to begin our look at Revelation, but we're not going to be looking at Revelation. In 2 weeks we're going to start our actual study of Revelation, but tonight is sort of our practice session where we get familiar with how to read really difficult books. And when I say difficult books, to me Revelation is a difficult book. When you read through Revelation, we typically say, I don't know what this is talking about. And I want to start just by reading a little section of Revelation. Turn over to Revelation 12, just to kind of give us this concept of Revelation is different. And you read through Matthew, you read through Mark, you read through Luke, you kind of know what you're reading. It's pretty normal, sort of, this is what Jesus did, then he did that, and we can relate to it pretty well. But then you get to a book like Revelation, and it's not like that anymore. We could have picked just about any page in Revelation, but here in Revelation 12, verse 1, here's what it says. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and crying out in birth pain, the pains, and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven, behold a great red dragon with 7 heads, and 10 horns, and on his heads 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. And it continues. And you read that and you say, that's a weird book. I mean, there's nothing there we can relate to. I mean, a woman who's wearing the sun, she's standing on the moon. She's wearing a crown that's made out of the stars. There's a dragon that attacks her, and it's got 7 heads, and it's got a tail that's so big it sweeps down the stars when it waves its tail. I mean, this is weird. This is really strange stuff. And I think for that reason, for some people, it's exciting, it's fun, like, whoa, what a weird book. For other people, we read that and we say, I don't know what it means. You just don't want to have anything to do with it because it's just too bizarre. I think for the original readers, it may not have been quite as weird. We read that and we say, I've never read anything like that except maybe if it were Star Wars or something. I mean, it's to us, if we're going to relate to anything, it's going to be some weird science fiction something. But they did have something to relate this to. And so, can anyone think of any other books of the Bible that have a similar kind of writing style?
Daniel.
Book of Daniel. Yes. When you get to the second half of Daniel, you get to a lot of very similar kind of stuff. In fact, some of it's so similar that it's very obvious that the book of Revelation is referencing us back to the book of Daniel. So the Jews who are reading this and the Christians who are reading the book of Revelation, as soon as they were familiar with the Bible, which we hope they were, would have read this and said, I kind of feel like I read this before. This kind of sounds like what we read back in the Old Testament from Daniel. Any other books of the Bible that have some similar, that seem similar to this?
I was thinking of Ezekiel.
Ezekiel, yes. When we say Ezekiel, there were several passages that were kind of odd like this, where we have visions that were just a lot of strange stuff going on. And then, of course, the scripture reading we just did was from the book of Zechariah, which also has a lot of strange visions like this. So tonight I want to talk about some keys of understanding the book of Revelation. And I want to say that it seems weird, but what this actually is this is a particular kind of writing style. It's just like today when you have different kinds of books are written in different genres. You can have a murder mystery, you can have science fiction, fantasy, poetry, a lot of different sorts of writing styles. And for each of those, they have their own sets of characteristics. That when you pick up a murder mystery, you know it's going to be different than a biography. There's just certain things you can expect. If you're reading The Lord of the Rings, you can expect there's going to be certain sorts of characters and stuff because it's fantasy. It's not surprising if you have an elf in a fantasy book. It's not surprising if you have a dwarf or a wizard in a fantasy book. Now, if you're reading a biography of Abraham Lincoln and you have a dwarf or an elf, it's a weird book. And that's when you come to Revelation, if you come with the wrong expectations, you're going to go, wait, that's a weird book. I just read the book of John and it made sense, but then I read the book of Revelation and it didn't make sense. But if you come at it saying, this is a different genre, this is written in some different format, more like the format of the book of Daniel, then we come with expectations expecting these sorts of things. And what you find when you think about it as a genre, there are certain ways of communicating that you only find in this particular genre. And certain characters and stuff that you only find in this. Just like a fantasy book has certain characteristics that are unique to that. In few things that you'll see when you're studying through this kind of a genre is this perspective is different. Instead of written from a human perspective, most of it is written from a top-down perspective. It's more like God's perspective on things. So even though we're down on earth and we're seeing stuff, the things that are revealed are typically, here's the way God sees it. So right away, that's going to change things a lot. Secondly, it's written with a lot of imagery, where very few things are actually literal. Instead, everything's described with these elaborate creatures and beasts and things. And sometimes people read that and think, well, he must have been writing it that way so that we wouldn't understand what he was saying. He wanted to write it so that when we just read this, we say, oh, dragons, I don't know what it means. And God was trying to mislead us and just confuse us. I don't think that's the case. I think actually what's going on with a lot of these books like this, it'll explain. It'll give us some imagery and it'll say, and this is what it means. Not as much in Revelation. Revelation seems to be even more difficult than some of these others, and there's less explanation. But in many of them, there are some explanations where he'll show you some imagery and then say, and this is why I'm showing you this. It means such and such. The reason it is written this way, I don't think it's to hide the message. It's actually a way that amplifies the message. It's a way that if you understand what the author's doing here, it becomes a very dramatic way to preach a sermon. That instead of just saying, well, you know, people are going to be persecuted, he tells you this big thing about a dragon and a woman running away from the dragon and all these monsters and stuff, and then it's a whole lot more vivid, and when you connect it all together, you say, wow. When we talk about Satan persecuting Christians, wow, that's intense. And it becomes very memorable, and it becomes something that's much more moving than a dry sermon. So, let's go about trying to understand this genre. And the way we're going to do it is by studying the book of Zechariah tonight. We're going to go through a few of the different visions in Zechariah, and we're going to learn 7 different keys of how to understand the genre that then we'll be able to take and apply to reading Revelation in the coming weeks. So, jump with me over to the book of Zechariah. And we're going to start in Zechariah chapter 1. The book of Zechariah has a number of visions. We're not going to hit all of them tonight. We'll hit enough of them to really get the flavor of this. So, as we have the scripture reading, it introduces us to, this is a message to some people from this prophet Zechariah. Put it into the time frame here. The time frame is during when they've come back from captivity. When the people they were in captivity for a long time, they finally come back and they're starting to try to rebuild things. Now, the first key I'm going to give here is understanding the context of this kind of writing is super, super helpful. It's something you want to do with any book of Bible you study, but especially with this. Because they're already dealing with so many confusing topics, if you don't understand the context, it's going to make it that much more confusing. So, the context of Zechariah, we've got these people who were way over here in Babylon, which then became Persia. They're over here, captives in Persia. And then God finally lets them go. King Cyrus gives this command that all the Jews can finally go home. So they go on this long journey up and around, and they finally come back to Jerusalem, the place that's been deserted for 70 years or so. And so they come back here, and when they get there, it's all ruined. I mean, all the houses are broken down, the wall is ruined, and everything just destroyed. And here, they're trying to follow God. I mean, here's all these people who just made this huge long trek, hundreds of miles across the area there, and they finally get back, and it's just, we've got a few people here in this big pile of ruins. And when I say few, I mean, it's much fewer than what we had when they were taken captive. In fact, there's a lot more people that are still back in Babylon than actually came back to rebuild this place. But a few did come back. And when they get there, it's tough. I mean, everything's broken down. There's all these enemies around. So we've got all these enemies surrounding them that are making things really hard on them. So it's a very dangerous situation. The walls are broken down, so there's no protection. It would have been very dangerous, very discouraging. And then what we find is you read through the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which give you a time period somewhat similar to Zechariah, is that not only were they dealing with all physical difficulties, they're dealing with spiritual difficulties too. Just like in any time period, you're going to have sin coming in, and they did. They had some of these people started intermarrying with some of the people of the land, and that started causing problems. And there were a bunch of other issues as well. So there was some sin problems. There was just the discouragement problems. Really difficult time. Time when God's people were very oppressed. So that gives us the background for this book. So once we understand the overall context, then we start to read these visions. So let's start in verse 7. Chapter 1, verse 7. On the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month of Shebat, in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, son of Iddo, saying, I saw in the night, and behold, a man riding on a red horse. He was standing among the myrtle trees in the glen, and behind him were red, sorrel, and white horses. Then I said, what are these, my lord? The angel who talked with me said to me, I will show you what they are. So the man who was standing among the myrtle trees answered, these are they whom the Lord had sent to patrol the earth. And they answered the angel of the Lord who was standing among the myrtle trees and said, we have patrolled the earth, and behold, all the earth remains at rest. That's the beginning of our vision. So, what's the setting? Let's imagine it like a play. We're watching the stage, and here's what's happening on the stage. I think that's a great way to think about visions. First step is, the second key here is visualize the vision. There's a reason why it's a vision. If it wasn't meant to be seen, it wouldn't have been shown to him in a visual kind of way. It's very important to realize that when you get to a vision in the Bible, it's visual. And if I can't visualize it, I'm going to have a hard time understanding it. So always start with visualizing it. So let's get the backdrop for the stage. What's our background for the stage? How's our setting?
It's nighttime.
Nighttime. Okay, so it's all dark here. And where are we at? Some kind of field thing. So we've got like some grass or something around here. What kind of plants? I think it's
myrtle trees.
There we go. We've got these myrtle trees. I don't know what a myrtle tree is, but we've got
trees.
What's that?
Like an evergreen.
Oh, okay. All right. So do it more like evergreen trees. Okay. So here we've got, he's standing. So we've got these trees, and then we've got character here. Who's the first character we meet?
The man riding on a red horse.
Okay. So here's our horse, and here's our guy riding on that horse. Okay. So, yes? Oh, does it say it's a valley? Okay. All right. Glen or valley? Okay. All right. So, we meet this guy on this horse. He's riding on this red horse. And then we meet a few other horses. What other horses do we meet? All right, so we've also got another red horse with a rider on it, and a sorrel, and then a white. Okay, and then someone has a question. Who has a question here? Was that Zechariah? I'm trying to think.
Yeah,
all right, Zechariah has a question, and he says, what are these? Good question. That's what we're wondering too. So this really helped me ask the question we're wondering. What's going on here? Now, this is not as weird as what we saw in Revelation, but it's still, why are we seeing a picture of a bunch of horses? And so what does the angel explain to him?
I'll show you what they are.
All right, I'm going to show you what they are. Okay, and then he starts to explain, and what does he explain these are? Okay, this is really helpful. Now we're getting some explanation. These guys are, God is sending to patrol the earth. Okay, so now we know why we're seeing these guys. Apparently God is sending out these guys to control the earth. Now, let's keep going here with the vision. It says, verse 11, and they answered the angel of the Lord who was standing among the myrtle trees and said, we have controlled the earth, and behold, all the earth remains at rest. All right, so their response after they've gone and they've controlled the whole earth, looked around the whole entire earth, they say, everything is at rest. All right, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, that seems good. We like rest. That sounds good. And then we get a surprising statement. Verse 12, then the angel of the Lord said, O Lord of hosts, how long will you have the mercy on Jerusalem and the cities of Judah against which you have been angry these 7 years? And the Lord answered gracious and comforting words to the angel who talked with me. So the angel who talked with me said to me, cry out, thus says the Lord of hosts, I am exceedingly jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion, and I am exceedingly angry with the nations that are at ease, for while I was angry but a little, they furthered the disaster. Therefore, thus says the Lord, I have returned to Jerusalem with mercy. My house shall be built in it, declares the Lord of hosts, and the measuring line shall be stretched out over Jerusalem. Cry out again, thus says the Lord of hosts, my city shall again overflow with prosperity, and the Lord will again comfort Zion and again choose Jerusalem. All right, so this guy says, this guy seems, I believe it's this guy if I'm reading it right, gives a question to God, and he says, when are you going to have mercy? When are you going to have mercy on Jerusalem? And God responds, and what's the summary of God's response? What do you think? He says, I'm going to be jealous for Jerusalem. He says, in fact, what I'm going to do is it sounds like he's going to punish these enemy nations. He's angry. Yeah, he says he's angry with these enemy nations because of all the things they've done against his people, is what it sounds like. And he's jealous of his people. They've been hurt. And so God's saying, I'm going to take care of things now. And so at first we came into this thinking, oh, rest is a good thing. Everything's at rest. Everything's peaceful. But for those exiles who come back, they're saying, life is not fair. We're trying to serve God, and we're being oppressed by our enemies. We're having such a hard time here. And I don't think God even notices. And God gives them a vision here saying, look, I just patrolled the whore. I know what's happening. And I'm about to do exactly what you want me to do. I'm going to be merciful to you. And the way I'm going to be merciful is by taking care of the problem of all of the evil people who are making things so hard on you right now. So there's our explanation so far. Now, when do you think God did that? I don't know. I don't know precisely. I mean, we could say different times that he did punish enemies and stuff. But here's the next key to this. We typically think of visions in these kinds of books as a history lesson. If I just understood what this is saying that about 47 years in the future, God's going to send this army, he's going to do this, and then he's going to do this. That's usually the wrong way to think of it. Better way to think of it is not as a history lesson, but as a sermon. It's much more like the other prophets, where God's revealing a message, and his message is not for the purpose of saying, here's exactly the details of what's going to happen in the future, but his message is, here's what you need to know so you can live your life differently. And so he gives them a vision that gives us the abstract idea that the enemies are going to be punished, and that he's watching and he's patrolling the earth. But for me to match this up with any historical event, maybe not, probably not. I mean, I could guess some things, but he's not trying to be specific about a lot of historical events in this particular vision. Now, the other part of that is, we might look at this and say, well, now, why is it a red horse? Why is this one red? Why didn't we have a dapple horse? And which horse is which? Is this horse Assyria? Is this horse Babylon? With this vision, we're already way off base when we do that. In this vision, it's a whole lot easier than that. It's just God saying, I'm patrolling the earth. I'm walking around. I'm aware of what's going on. And I'm about to answer your big question and deal with the problem. But he gives it to us in a very visual way where we picture God sending out these angels that are riding on the horses all around the earth and looking here and looking there. And it puts into our minds that we say, yeah, God is really watching what's going on here, even when we don't realize it. Okay. Any thoughts on that? I think
and
so.
They got discouraged.
Yeah.
And so this is how, you know, the Zechariah God's way of encouraging them.
Yes.
To keep going.
Great point. Yes, absolutely. And so that, yes.
There could be some history with this particular one. Okay. You mentioned the 70 years. And that was the
yes.
prophecy,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they were going to be in exile for 70 years and they were going to come back.
Yeah.
And this happens during the reign of Darius, and that's when the enemies made them stop building the temple.
Yeah.
So maybe this is like, okay, God says, okay, I'm going to get this stuff going again.
Yeah.
So maybe a little bit of history in this.
Great point. Okay. Yeah. Which with that, it's not so much history looking forward and saying, like, what do these things represent?
No.
But it's historical context of what was going on. Yeah, great point. That is really important. Okay, so here's the next key. Start with the message to the original reader. That's what Anne gave us. And then find the message to us. Don't flip it around. And this is a key for any Bible study, but it's really important when you get to these kinds of books. Start with what did it mean to the original readers. Once we understand that, then we can say, well, now what do I learn from it too? Which the things I can learn from is very similar to what they learned from it, which is God's watching, he's taking care of things, and even when I think that things aren't right here in this world, since he's aware of things, in his time, he can take care of them. Okay, so that's the first vision. Let's go on to the next vision. Let's go to the next verse, verse 18. And I lifted my eyes and saw and behold four horns. And I said to the angel who talked with me, what are these? And he said to me, these are the horns that have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Then the Lord showed me four craftsmen. And I said, what are these coming to do? He said, these are the horns that scattered Judah so that no one raised his head. And these have come to terrify them, to cast down the horns of the nations who lifted up their horns against the land of Judah to scatter it. Okay. So, new stage. We don't really have any scene for this one, but what are the characters? Horns. Now this, I do not think it's horns that you blow. This is horns like on an animal. Spiky horns. So, here we've got these four disembodied horns. All right, so there's our four horns. And this brings us to another weird thing about this kind of literature is, to us, anywhere that we read about just four horns doing stuff, that's weird. But in this literature, it's not. In this kind of literature, it's okay to have just weird things going on like that because it's not trying to describe something literal. It's not saying that someday you're going to be walking down the street and you're going to see this big horn just coming down the street. It's not saying that. It's going to teach us some kind of lesson. So, there's four horns. And who are the other characters?
Craftsmen.
Okay, so let's see. There's craftsmen. Here's the craftsmen. Here's the craftsmen. And here's their craftsmen. Okay, they got hammers. So here's our four craftsmen, and then he gives us the answer to what this all means, and what does it mean. First of all, what are these four horns?
Nations.
Okay, so these are the nations. The nations particularly that did what?
Scattered Judah
everywhere. So we think of Babylon, we think of Assyria, or really Babylon would be the major one. Go ahead.
Daniel also used horns, and they were also represented nations.
Yes, great point. And so that one, I don't know if I have this as a key here. One of the big things that's so helpful is once you really start to understand the genre, you'll see certain patterns that show up a lot in this. If in Daniel he uses horns represent nations. Then we get to another book, and we're like, well, why is there a horn here? Maybe it represents nations. So a lot of times, we start to understand the writer's vocabulary by reading a lot of this kind of literature. Okay, so these nations that scattered Judah, but then we've got the craftsmen. And what do the craftsmen do?
They
terrify the horns. Okay, I think that's all the teacher tells us. Is that all the information we have? Any other information left out? Okay, so now we try to figure out what that's actually talking about. Well, this fortune line, he gave us a lot of explanation. So we've got nations that cause all sorts of problems. Oh, go ahead, John.
In a sense, this vision is showing God's judgment on the nations that afflicted Israel.
Yeah. Great point.
Which is
exactly what he said earlier.
Part of it was alluded to in the previous vision. Mm-hmm. God said, this is my answer.
Yeah.
I will take care of it.
Yes. Great point. And what's strange to me is that it's craftsmen that do it. I would think it would be another horn. Like, if horn means power of nation, then what we should have is then there's four bigger horns to come in and destroy them. But he changes everything with this, it's craftsmen. And I don't know, there may be different reasons for this. One thing that really comes to my mind is the message to these exiles, that what they need to be doing right now is rebuilding. That it's this whole time period is a message to them, rebuild. Time to go back, rebuild the temple, rebuild the wall. And so God gives them this message of he's going to defeat all these other nations through building, through craftsmen. Kind of interesting concept there, that that's going to be the solution to it. Okay, few keys from this. One is don't take most images literally. You've got horns. He's not really talking about horns walking around the street. He's talking about it. He talks about nations. And then, a lot of times, don't take numbers literally. Why are there four horns? I don't know. Maybe it was four different nations. The different people who try to do that, it's hard. I mean, what would the four nations be? We could have Syria, Babylon, Persia. What's the fourth nation? That's tough if you think it's literally four different nations. A lot of times, it's the number just represents like maybe four, as in the four directions of the compass. The same reason we have four riders is it just sort of these nations, this power that covered the earth. Maybe it's something much simpler like that. A lot of times, throughout this kind of writing, when you get a number, don't go there and say, all right, well, I got to count it and make sure that this means that's so many people or whatever. Typically doesn't. Usually the number is there for some symbolic purpose rather than for an actually literally that's how many of this or how many years or how many people or something. All right, let's get to another vision. Chapter 2, verse 1. And I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Then I said, where are you going? And he said to me, to measure Jerusalem, to see what its width and what is its length. And behold, the angel who talked with me came forward, and another angel came forward to meet him and said to him, run, save that young man. Jerusalem shall be inhabited as villages without walls because of the multitude of the people and livestock in it. And I will be to her a wall of fire around, declares the Lord, and will be the glory in her midst. Okay, so now who's the main character in this vision? A man with this measuring line. So here's this guy, and he's got this big measuring tool here. And he's measuring. What does it seem like he's probably measuring? Yes, this city, or is it Jerusalem, or how is it?
Jerusalem.
Okay, so he's measuring Jerusalem here. Now, at this point, when this is being written, Jerusalem's not really all that great to measure. It's a broken down city. Now, when you measure things? When you build something. And that might be what's going on here. So that might be a construction thing. But then he goes on with the vision, and he says, he's measuring it, and then he says, Jerusalem is going to be inhabited. And how does he describe the inhabited?
Villages without walls.
As villages without walls. Now, that sounds bad. We need walls for defense. But he says, here's why. What's his reason for why it's going to have no walls?
The multitude of people in
Bible. The multitude of people in Bible. Kind of turns it around, it seems like, and saying, describing this time when there will be so many people that you can't have a wall. A wall contains things, but there's going to be so many people stuffed inside the city that they just can't even have a wall anymore. So this picture of this massive number of people that are in the city. Because they don't have any walls, what's the solution instead? God's going to protect it, and he describes it as a wall of fire. God's going to be this wall of fire all the way around the city. Okay, what's the story the Bible can think of that has fire all the way around the city? Well, there you go. I thought about Gideon. Yeah. I was thinking about the protection of, we just said it in Kings, when the servant, Elisha's servant said, oh no, we're being attacked. And Elisha says, oh, open his eyes. And all of a sudden he sees all these fiery horses and chariots all around. God, it's God's angelic army protecting the city. Now, I bring up that to say, and that's a very vague allusion. I don't know if that's a valid allusion or not, but a lot of times with this kinds of writing, it's really good to look for allusions to other parts of the Bible, especially when you get to Revelation. Revelation is filled with allusions to the Old Testament. In fact, some people have estimated, and different people get different counts when they count this, some people have counted this and said there's more allusions to the Old Testament than there are verses in the book of Revelation. That we're saying, every verse, basically, we've got multiple things going on where it'll reference something over here, reference something over here, just with these, not a quotation, but just something where it's vaguely using some imagery from some other part of the Bible. And if you read that in the Bible, then when you see ring of fire around the city, you start thinking, oh yeah, it's kind of like how God protected Elisha. Mm-hmm. And it adds this richness to it, and a lot of it really helps you understand the concept that's being taught here. So, he's telling them, look, here you are in this city, and it's going to be so many people in the city, you can't even have walls, but it's okay, because I'll be protecting you. Now, in this one, God then starts doing a little preaching and explains a little further on this. Verse 6, up, up, flee from the land of the north, declares the Lord, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heavens, declares the Lord. Up, escape to Zion, you who dwell with the daughter of Babylon. For thus said the Lord of hosts, after his glory sent me to the nations who plundered you, for he who touches you touches the apple of my eye. Behold, I will shake my hand over them, and they shall become plunder for those who serve them. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for behold, I come, and I will dwell in your midst, declares the Lord, and many nations shall join themselves to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people, and I shall dwell in your midst, and you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. And the Lord will inherit Judah as his portion in the Holy Land and will again choose Jerusalem. Okay, so what's the application that God wanted them to learn from this? What did he say in all that?
God has a plan.
God has a plan. Okay, very good. Yeah. And he starts out with this up, up, up. He's telling people in Babylon over here, he's like, get to Jerusalem. Now, all the people in Babylon are kind of like, well, Jerusalem's kind of falling apart, there's no walls, I don't think I really want to be there. He's like, no, you get back to Jerusalem, that's where you're supposed to be. And he's like, because we're measuring it, we're building right now, and there's going to be so many people here, we can't even have walls for them all, but that's okay, because I'm going to be protecting it. Totally different vision, a totally different concept of it.
Most of the time, the measuring line is used in the Bible as a judgment. God measures people, and they don't measure up, and he has to destroy them. So, maybe in this case, maybe they're finally measuring up.
That's interesting. That could be. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It does seem like a lot of times in the prophets, it's a judgment kind of thing. Yeah, that is interesting. Okay, so message is get back here, and God's going to be your protection. So there's the call to action. All right, let's finish up with just a couple more visions real fast, because I really want to hit these ones in chapter 5. Jump over to chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 1. Again, I lifted my eyes and saw, behold, a flying scroll. And he said to me, what do you see? I answered, I see a flying scroll. its length is 20 cubits and its width 10 cubits. Then he said to me, this is a curse that goes out over the face of the whole land. For everyone who steals shall be cleaned out according to what is on one side, and everyone who swears falsely shall be cleaned out according to what is on the other side. I will send it out, declares the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter the house of the thief and the house of him who swears falsely by my name, and it shall remain in his house and consume it, both timber and stone. Okay, this one is another really weird one. One of these things that you just can't picture in real life very well. But when you visualize it, I think it really helps you. So here he says, I saw this flying scroll. Here's this huge scroll flying through the air. And it's huge. You get the dimensions of it. And it's really massive. I mean, bigger than a car. Yeah, go ahead.
It's interesting that the dimension that was given to this scroll is the exact measurement of the tabernacle.
Interesting. Okay. That's very interesting. Okay. So, you've got this message written on it, and it's a message of judgment. And it's flying through the air, and it comes to the house of the thief, and it goes inside, and what happens to that house? Bam! It's destroyed. I mean, it's just obliterated when this flying scroll comes in. Okay, weird vision. And we're thinking, well, when's that going to happen? Are we going to have a flying scroll come through town? No, that's not what I'm talking about. But it's a really great way to communicate what? When you visualize that, what does it communicate to you? Judgment. Yes, judgment. And what is the judgment coming from? The Word. God could have said, I'm going to punish you because you didn't follow what I said. But he says it this way because it's a much more visual way to show that when you don't take God's word seriously and you don't follow it, it's going to come and it's going to be like this Godzilla monster scroll that comes and destroys you. That's what it's describing, but in a much more visual kind of way. All right, let's hit the last one. Verse 5. I really like this one. Verse 5. Then the angel who talked with me came forward and said to me, lift your eyes and see what this is that is going out. And I said, what is it? He said, this is the basket that is going out. And he said, this is their iniquity in all land. And behold, the leaden cover was lifted, and there was a woman sitting in the basket. And he said, this is wickedness. And he thrust her back into the basket and thrust down the leaden weight on its opening. Okay, that's the first part of the vision. So these visions are getting stranger as we go. Now we've got it starts out with this basket. So here's this basket. And he asks, what's this basket? He says, this is wickedness. And he opens the lid to the basket, and there's this lady inside. So here's this wickedness that's in the basket. And then they shut the lid. How did they shut the lid, and what do they do when they shut the lid? What's that? They put a big weight on it. So there's this big, big, huge lead weight they put on it so that she doesn't get out. Wickedness is trapped in this basket. Then verse 9, then I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, two women coming forward. The wind was in their wings. They had wings like the wings of a stork. And they lifted up the basket between earth and heaven. And then I said to the angel who talked with me, where are they taking the basket? He said to me, to the land of Shinar, to build a house for it. And when this is prepared, they will set the basket down there on its base. So now we have two women who come, and they have wings. So here are these two women who show up with these wings, and they fly off with this basket, the lid on it, and they fly way over here, over to the land of Shinar here. And he says they're going to build a house for it, and that's where they're going to put it. All right, well, we read all that, and we say, that's weird, this is really strange stuff. What's it possibly mean? Okay, well, Shinar over here, anybody know about the geographical location of Shinar, where it was? Babylon. It was kind of the area where the exiles had come from. And now they've come over to Jerusalem. So here we've got, I assume somewhere around Jerusalem or something, and we've got this wickedness, and he says, let's put all the evil in the basket and put a lid on it, this man of lead, so we're never going to be able to open it again, and then let's ship it off, send it back to Babylon. Yes. That, yes, that's very interesting. Yes, it is. Yeah, so, ship it off there, build a house for it so it stays there and never comes back. Now, think about what that means.
Exile.
Yes, now this is after exile. This is after people have returned. So it's kind of like he's saying, listen guys, you come back to this land. Don't bring all your wickedness with you. Send it back. It doesn't belong over here. Leave that wickedness back where you came from. That's where it's supposed to be. And it gives us this dramatic imagery of it, of don't let it come out. We're going to stick it in the box, we're going to seal it up, and we're going to mail it next day air so it gets there as quickly as possible, and send it there so it stays there forever. And that's where the wickedness needs to set. This idea of when they come back to the land, let's leave the sin behind. Okay, any thoughts on that?
See the vision of the scroll. That's God's judgment, divine judgment on sin.
Yeah.
In Israel that they have.
Yeah.
You see, in this vision, that's his removal of it, getting rid of it.
Cool. I like that. Yeah. Good connection. Okay, well, that's the vision we're going to hit tonight. So, what I wanted to show from all this, here's seven keys to understanding this. What I really want to show from all of that is that when you first read these, it seems weird, confusing, strange. And when we get to Revelation, I think it's going to be more so. Most of the visions in Revelation are even more bizarre than this. But if we can go about reading it as understanding that this is a different kind of writing style, and it's written as a sermon, it's written to teach those people at that time something, and once we understand that it teaches them something, that it'll teach us something, if we can go about reading it in that kind of way, that's when we can really get some benefit from it. And as we can see from these, they're really relevant. There's a lot of lessons there that are very relevant and very visual so that we remember it and it sticks in our mind and really helps us understand these concepts. All right, well, let's all work on our Bible study. If you have time, read Revelation before, tune in tonight and start Revelation. So read it ahead of time if you can, and we'll start working through some of that imagery. If you're not a Christian, then we invite you tonight to come and get rid of sin. Let God take care of that sin, forgive that sin, take it away. And come to Him tonight while together we stand and we sing.